Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today's guests, Sheldon Richman and Jeffrey Tucker. And I also hope, Giorgio Caffiero, who's a reporter for Foreign Policy and Focus, and writes about Libya, writes informed things about Libya, my favorite. So, gonna see if we can get Giorgio back on the show. So that'd be cool. Sheldon is going to talk about the real nuclear threat to the Middle East. You guess. Or, you know, apply knowledge that you have. And Jeff Tucker's going to be on to talk about the cops. I think that'll be interesting. Also, bad news. But before the bad news, good news. You can listen to archives of all of my interviews at scotthorton.org. So stop by there. And another piece of good news is that, that's bad news. I forgot to turn off the air conditioner, and so now it's going to make noise. Sorry about that. I'll fix it in a minute. But the other piece of good news is that Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a giant thing at the LBJ Auditorium at the LBJ Library on Red River and 26th Street, a.k.a. Dean Keaton Boulevard, here in Austin, right off I-35. And he's going to be hosting Glenn Greenwald, expert on the National Security Agency documents and the surveillance state and all kind of Bill of Rightsy stuff like that. And Radley Balco, expert on the militarization of the police and the war on drugs and all kinds of homeland security type issues along those lines. And Ron Paul will be headlining. And he's the expert on how George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama got us into this mess. And I don't know what his solution is going to be. I hope he just sticks to just come home. It sounds like... I don't think we're going to have to worry about that. So that's pretty cool, huh? Jacob Hornberger hosting. And then it's Greenwald, Balco, and Ron Paul. Any of the three could be the headliner, really, if you think about it. And that's at the LBJ Library Auditorium on Red River and Dean Keaton here in Austin. It's Red River is the first north-south road to the east of I-35. Nope. Strike that, reverse it. To the west of I-35. I don't know why I said that. I had my map and my brain turned around. There you go. To the west of I-35, Red River, just one block west of I-35 at Dean Keaton Boulevard, and there's the LBJ Library. I don't know where the hell you're going to park, though. I mean, there's a giant parking lot, but you can't park there, so I don't know how they're going to do that. Probably follow the signs. And it's at 1 o'clock, so my plan is to get there early, I hope. So, see you there. That's this Saturday at 1 o'clock. Oh, you got to register. So, go to fff.org. Let's see what we got here. I got an email inviting me to go and click this and that to go register, but that might not work for you. If you didn't get the email, you wouldn't know what to click. So let me see what we got here at fff.org. Register now, free, right there near the top. Stop the wars on drugs and terrorism. April 11th, 2015, Austin, Texas. Ron Paul, Glenn Greenwald, and Radley Balco. Register now free. There's the link you're going to want to click. Hey, wait a minute. That link doesn't work. Really? Wait. Let me hit refresh here. There it goes. That's fine. Register now free. It's right there at the top of fff.org, the website of the Future Freedom Foundation. I'm really looking forward to that. And, did I neglect to mention that it's also being put on by the Young Americans for Liberty, which is good. Cool. Oh, here's the whole schedule. Hornberger, then Jeff Frazee from the Young Americans for Liberty, then Riley Balco, and then Glenn Greenwald, and then Ron Paul. Oh, and then a panel discussion. And then closing remarks by Frazee and Hornberger. So cool, man. It goes from 1 to 6:30. I didn't really realize that. I thought it was going to be like an hour and a half. They're each going to give a speech. 2 hours or something. But there you go. So it's all afternoon. Ron goes on at 4:50. And then, cool, they're going to do a panel discussion, too. And I guess, does that include questions and answers? I bet it probably does. So, right on. All right. So I think I said everything about that that I need to say. FFF.org. The Future of Freedom Foundation. Thank you. All right. And then, cool. I still have a couple of minutes for the break. When we get back, I'll talk about the controversy and the different versions of the Iran nuclear deal and the probability of it actually being finalized. If anybody could screw this up, it would be this president. But anyway, so what I'll tell you in the meantime, I'm glad I have just a minute to mention this. 5 ways that nuclear Armageddon was almost unleashed. And they're not even talking about accidents. They're just talking about during the Cold War, during the 67 war, America almost got into it over Egypt. Got into it with Russia. And then, I'm already on the second page. That's my problem here. I wonder why that didn't look familiar. First of all, they talk about the Berlin Wall. And West Berlin, as an American Western city, completely within communist East Germany. And all the various crises that could have led to war with Russia. What an insane policy at that point. I mean, it seems fair to promise the people of West Berlin, like, here, we'll airlift you out of here, but what the hell kind of tripwire for war was that? Holding on to West Berlin all that time. It's amazing it didn't happen. Then there's, of course, Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And then there's the war the Soviet generals wanted in Vietnam. And it starts by saying that in November 1965, Lyndon Johnson exploded with rage at the Joint Chiefs, who wanted him to expand the war, and he was accusing them of being willing to get into a nuclear war over Vietnam. I guess basically they were saying we should invade and conquer and defeat the North. And Johnson, of course, drew the line way before that because it would have escalated the war, he assumed. But then he says, after the Soviet collapse, previously censored memoirs of a Khrushchev political ally, Mikoyan, were finally published in Russia. He related a chilling story also from 1965. The Soviet general staff, incensed by the U.S. bombing of Vietnam and earlier U.S. action in the Dominican Republic, suggested increasing pressure on Berlin. And the military's position staggered him, he wrote, and Soviet military leaders aghast squashed the idea quickly. But with both sides looking to make Vietnam a larger fight, however, it's lucky that the spring of 65 didn't turn out to be a lot hotter than it already was. And then he says 1973, and then this is the most famous accident, 1983, where there was a exercise, but the Soviets thought it was real. It was only because they had such good spies in NATO that assured them it was just a practice and not the beginning of a war that stopped them from striking first. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, so Rand Paul's giving a foreign policy speech in front of an aircraft carrier right now. You want to listen?
Wisdom to know when war is necessary and when war is not necessary. I promise you this, I will never forget our veterans. I will never forget our...
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to. Anyway, so we got a problem with the nuclear talks. Yosef Butt wrote this thing for The Hill all about it. Poison pills in the Tehran deal, in the Iran nuclear agreement. He's going to be on the show tomorrow to talk about it. But the problem is, I guess, I don't know. We're still talking about John Kerry here, right? So, seems like maybe there was a little bit of a misunderstanding about when the sanctions will be lifted. Will it be as the Iranians implement the agreement or as they agree to the agreement? The Iranians are saying, we're not doing anything until you guys lift the sanctions. The deal is, on the day of the handshake and the big signing, you guys lift the sanctions. Then we'll do all the stuff we said we're going to do. And of course, to the Americans, oh, geez, we never said that. Although, you could see them lifting the sanctions in short order when it comes to shutting down the enrichment centrifuge cascades at Fordo and that kind of thing, taking all that stuff offline and beginning to convert it into a research facility, that kind of thing. Those, you know, that stage of sanctions, you could do a quid for a pro for a quo on that and do another one when they shut down the heavy water facility at Iraq and begin to convert it into a light water reactor. Reconfigure it so it doesn't produce weapons-grade plutonium. You could start doing that pretty soon. Could go ahead and let them inspect stupid Parchin again and finish putting to bed the ridiculous presumed forgeries, the so-called alleged studies, and possible military dimensions, all of which is already debunked completely, of course, by Gareth Porter and others, including Robert Kelly, former IAEA, some kind of mucky-muck at the very top, and including their former director, Mohammed El-Baradei, and even Ali Heinonen, who is the hawk from the IAEA, who's always feeding all the hawkers' talking points to hacks like David Sanger at the New York Times, has admitted that, well, you know, the Germans got them from the MEK cult, and so we don't really know. Yeah, it just means the Israelis. This is a guy who's happy to, you know, smuggle Israeli information into the stream by saying, well, it comes from a member state, right? The Israelis, they have hundreds of nukes. They're not members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They do not have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA, but they are members of the IAEA because actually the IAEA even predates the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They just got the job of enforcing the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the safeguards agreements, but they already existed as the Atoms for Peace, internationalization of nuclear technology situation. So other organization. So countries can join them separate and outside of any part of participation in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but then they still get to call themselves an IAEA member state. So Ali Heinonen likes to do that when what he means is Israel. And even he is on the record saying that it's doubtful that the alleged studies are even legitimate in the first place. And most of them are already thoroughly debunked anyway. And admittedly, you know, according to the IAEA, oh yeah, this issue was resolved and this issue was resolved. Oh, what about those magnets? Yeah, here they are on this balancing machine for this non-nuclear device. Oh, okay. That issue's resolved. That issue's resolved. What's the discrepancy in this paperwork here? Oh, okay. That issue's resolved. They've been doing this. So put to bed the rest of the alleged studies and the possible military dimensions. That should be easy enough. So, you know, maybe this is just theater and the Iranians and the Americans have already figured out what they're going to do and settling this in the meantime. They still have till the end of June. But they could just agree, listen, you guys start implementing really quickly and we'll start lifting sanctions really quickly, okay? But anyway, I don't know, man. It's not over yet. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu said on TV just last Sunday on all the morning news shows that he still will do everything he can to kill the deal. Mostly meaning in our Congress, the prime minister of a foreign country has determined here's what his lackeys are going to do. And in fact, there's even a surprisingly honest representation in the New York Times about what tools the Republican Party in Congress are now of the Israelis and how they just will not brook any dissent whatsoever from their line. So they could still kill it. And you know what? One of the problems is I really like Twitter. I love hate Twitter. One of the things I don't like about it is sometimes really important things can just be too reduced. Someone asked me today to argue about natural rights theory in Twitter, and I thought, you know, I don't know, man. Might need more space. Well, I saw the supreme leader of Iran, so-called, the Ayatollah Khamenei, saying, no way, man, you guys got to lift the sanctions first. Really, it's on Twitter. As people are. And that's what they put out. You lift the sanctions, then we'll start implementing. Now, you know what? There's just not too much room to negotiate on Twitter. Stop negotiating on Twitter. We need these ridiculous lawyers and liars and politicians to hash this out in a subtle kind of a way, man. Not on Twitter. And anyway, the point should be made, before I run completely out of time, that Iran never was making nuclear weapons. The worst way you could spin their nuclear program is they built it up to be a giant bargaining chip so they could get some of their sanctions lifted. You know, that's a huge part of what's going on here in the first place. And back when they gave George W. Bush their golden offer in 2003, they had a couple of hundred centrifuges testing. They had no cascades ready for production. They were doing research and development. And he told them to go to hell. Back when he could have negotiated a great deal. And he refused to even talk to them. We don't talk to evil, blah, 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 they said, for the entire Bush years. In fact, Bush even directly intervened in a way that helped lead to the presidency of Ahmad and Ahmadinejad. In 2005, saying, you, in a message directly to the Iranian people, don't you elect the right winger, better not do it. And anyway, so there's nothing to be scared of, there never was. And now they'll just have extra expanded inspections to double extra verify it. So, okay, it's fine. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Sheldon Richmond from Free Association. That's SheldonRichmond.com. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Sheldon?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thanks for inviting me back.
Good deal. Very happy to have you here. Hey, so you got this article. We're running it today on antiwar.com, too. It's called The Real Nuclear Threat in the Middle East. Well, surely you must be referring to the U.S. Air Force or Navy, right?
Well, I guess I could have said something about that, too. But in this case, I wanted to zero in on Israel.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was just kidding. Go ahead.
I mean, Israel is constantly haranguing Iran, not happy with this framework that's been, I guess, more or less agreed to. Even though it looks like Iran is making a huge amount of concessions in order to get sanctions lifted. But Israel has sort of put itself forward, in the person of Netanyahu, but he's got a lot of support, of course. He just got reelected, has put himself forward as the moral judge of Iran, accusing it of all kinds of things and telling the West and the U.S. in particular shouldn't even be dealing with Iran, and except for dropping bombs. I guess that's a way to deal with somebody. And yet it's Israel that's the nuclear monopolist that has attacked neighbors, that has that occupies territory, that oppresses the inhabitants of those occupied territories, that makes war on Gaza, open warfare on Gaza, the Gaza Strip. But every day grinds down the Palestinians of the West Bank and treats its own with quotation marks around that. Arab citizens as second or third class citizens, and you would never know that Israel has an awesome nuclear arsenal as well as an awesome conventional military force by the way this morality play is portrayed in the media.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. I think really it's almost just a matter of zooming in a little bit, because the narrative of tiny little Israel surrounded by enemies, I guess it does kind of make sense if you're just looking at a map out of focus, kind of, until you realize, well, actually, they own Egypt and Jordan outright. I mean, America pays the bill, but still, so those aren't enemies just because they're brown, assuming, their sovereignty over all the land to the Jordan River. And then in Syria, Assad might as well work for them. He's never messed with them at all. And Hezbollah, they don't like, but that's still just a militia and a defensive so-called threat, not an offensive one. And so, actually, they're not really surrounded by enemies. And actually, you know who's even a smaller little helpless society surrounded completely with their back to the sea, surrounded by enemies? The Gazans. They're the true, the fake narrative that they spin about Israel actually applies directly to their prisoners in the Gaza Strip. Whatever you call it, concentration camp.
Yeah. Well, right, and then now with Iran is the bête noire, right? The monster who's on the march, as Netanyahu put it in before when he spoke before the Congress. It's gobbling up nations, all of which is ridiculous. It's absurd. The exaggeration and the caricaturing of Iran is just so cynical. They've for a long time been an ally of Assad. There's nothing new there, and there's a civil war going on in Syria, and the U.S. is in a way on both sides of that. In Lebanon, Netanyahu will talk about Hezbollah, but Hezbollah only started to form when the central government of Lebanon was unable to protect the South Lebanese from Israel. Israel invaded in the 80s and stayed occupied lower Lebanon for many, many years. What was it, 15 years? There was no Hezbollah before that. So to act like that's some act of imperialism by Iran is wrong. And then even in Yemen, you know, I heard Christiane Amanpour say the other day on CNN that she's seen no evidence that the Houthis are basically agents of the Iranians. No, she's saying that. That's saying something.
Right.
She often finds she often is able to see evidence that no one else can see.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of expert opinion along those lines, and I've heard nothing contradicting that, really.
Yeah, and like I said, if she says it, that's saying something. So, you know, this is a fairy tale that Netanyahu and many in the United States, the neocons, the war party, is floating. That somehow, you know, and of course, the unspoken thing is, and I know you've pointed this out, if you're going to demonize Iran like this and just manufacture, to echo here Gareth Porter's great book, to manufacture a crisis that, you know, even aside from the so-called bogus nuclear crisis, that Iran is on the march like some sort of, you know, Nazi Germany in the Middle East, is to, by definition, I think, engender some sympathy for ISIS and for the worst of the radical Sunnis. Because you really can't be on both sides, and if you're going to be demonizing Iran, I think shows some sympathy for some very, very nasty people. Now, I'm not a fan of the Iranian regime. It's a theocracy. I don't want to live under any theocracy. But I think what the U.S. does there and what Israel does toward Iran certainly does not help to encourage a true liberal movement in Iran. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we could see, you know, leading up to and ever since the so-called Green Revolution in 2009 over the disputed election there, that the actual democratic, little d democratic activists there in Tehran, the number one accusation the government used against them was that you guys were all CIA. So maybe some of them appreciated, you know, NED money, and maybe some of them didn't. I don't know the exact proportions there, but certainly being painted as agents of the Americans is the number one, you know, worst public relations disaster that they could suffer. Just the same as, the way they try to accuse Snowden of leaking to the Russians or this kind of thing.
They did an article called the American Disease, which I think came out last year at one point. I think it was last year that I wrote this article, The American Disease, and it was exactly on that. If the U.S. is going to be doing what it's been doing for a very long time with, first of all, the CIA and then these non-governmental organizations, which look like they have some distance from the government, but really are, you know, filled with taxpayer money. Even when the U.S. is not involved in, let's say, liberal movement, it's going to be accused of it, given the history of it. And that's going to seem like a reasonable accusation to a lot of people. So, you know, the U.S. policy has created this very bad situation for genuine liberals in these places where they would like to have a peaceful revolution against an oppressive government. We've tainted them, even if we're not doing anything. Of course, we being the government, usually is doing something. But even if you could come up with a case where it wasn't, it would still be a reasonable, conclusion that the U.S. is probably behind it, given the fact that it's been behind so much else.
Yeah. And of course, what's funny there is Mousavi, the guy that was being supported in that Green Revolution, he's just another conservative Republican Ayatollah guy, part of the revolution since 79. And I think was already the former president in the 80s, something like this. He was no pro-Western American hero or whatever they were trying to paint him as. Like, oh, this guy, we like him. He would do what we say if it was him. But there's no reason to think that that any of that was true beyond just, you know, American self-centered projection. Like, oh, this looks like one of those color-coded revolutions we're always putting on. You know, maybe we could be the winners in this. What?
That's right. And then the people who point out that these are not genuine, that the U.S., the CIA, the NED is behind it, relatively easy to marginalize those people by just saying, oh, so you're in favor of the oppressive regime. I get it.
Right.
You know, so they can use that against them like they've done in Ukraine.
Yeah. Like they always try to do no matter what. You pro-Saddam Husseinite, you. We'll be right back, y'all, with the great Sheldon Richman in just a minute. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's me on the line with Sheldon Richman. He's at SheldonRichman.com. This piece is called The Real Nuclear Threat in the Middle East. Israel, of course, armed to the teeth with hundreds of A and H bombs and nuclear submarines, second strike capability, et cetera, like that. Not members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where at least nuclear weapon states that are members of it promise not to proliferate and lie that someday they'll get rid of theirs. They're not members of that. They're the ones sitting on all the nukes. And then I think it's very important that you point out in this article where Benjamin Netanyahu was trying to move the goalposts the other day and say the nuclear deal should include Iranian recognition of Israel. And Obama said, yeah, right, whatever. You know, forget about that pretty quick. But you point out in this article that the Iranians have been ready to recognize Israel for a long time now, and they've said so officially.
Well, that's right. That was one half of the reason I wanted to write this piece. I mean, I've written a lot about Iran and Israel, so I was wondering, why am I doing it again? What can I say that I haven't said? But one thing I haven't seen enough emphasized is Iran's stance over the years on a couple of things. Number one is what you just said. They announced in 2003, I think it is, they offered a grand bargain to the Bush administration, which would have, started negotiations on the nuclear matter, just to reassure the world that they're not building weapons. And as we know from Gareth's work and Mohammed Sahimi's work and others, they were not. And so it was willing to open all that up. And part of the grand bargain was embracing the Arab Leagues. And, this is something that just most people don't know anything about. It's not hardly ever discussed on the news. I shouldn't even say hardly ever. It's never discussed. The Arab League's 2002 peace initiative, which offered a comprehensive peace to the Israelis. It said if you settle the matter with the Palestinians, allow there to be a Palestinian state in the pre-67, the territories that were occupied in 67. And address the refugee problem within the context of UN resolutions, we will make peace with you. We will enter into treaties. I use this to refute Netanyahu, who says we can't have a nuclear weapons free zone or a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East until we have peace with the other Arab states recognize us. Well, they've been on record willing to recognize for many years. Iran has signed on to that. Iran supports a weapons of mass destruction free zone. It's renewed its call for that. But nobody ever talks about Iran making these overtures. By the way, that 2000 was it three offer by the Iranians mm-hmm. was rebuffed by the Bush administration. It was faxed to the Bush people by Switzerland because we weren't in direct contact over things like this with Iran. And the Bush people got mad at the Swiss for even faxing it. It was like, how dare you? How dare you bring this to our attention?
Right. Yeah. So, apparently there was a whole anecdote of them screaming at him, that kind of thing. I think it was John Bolton and his staff mm-hmm. really went after the Swiss ambassador personally for daring.
Yeah. So if you're going to talk about Iran, my point was talk about this stuff, too. Why is it the coverage of Iran, you know, merely demonization? You know, if you listen to the media and the, you know, the pundits, the analysts, all these professional experts they bring on, if they were talking about Israelis the way they talk about the Iranians, people would call them anti-Semites.
Yeah.
They would say, oh, well, the Iranians can't be trusted. They're so clever. They're deceitful. I mean, the Iranians. So, like I said, if you talk about the Israelis that way, Netanyahu would be screaming that you were anti-Semite, that you're saying Jews are deceitful. And I don't know why there's such a huge double standard. Well, I guess I do know why there's a huge double standard, but there is.
Yeah, there was just one the other day where Ron Dermer, the ambassador, who's an American, but the Israeli ambassador to the United States and the one who engineered the Netanyahu speech, supposedly, and all that, wrote an article in Time where it all starts out about the crafty Persian rug salesmen and how they're such hard bargainers or whatever. And immediately, even liberal Zionists were tweeting about, hey, man, if somebody wrote an essay like that that started with the Jewish diamond merchant, you'd be screaming at the top of your lungs. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I've seen references to the Persian bazaar, you know, where people are bargaining over rugs and other things. You're right. They play into all these sort of Orientalist stereotypes. They don't mind that at all. I mean, the mainstream media, the pundits, and the politicians don't mind that at all. Politicians, too. Every congressman you get before a camera will talk about those clever, deceitful Iranians. And you don't hear anybody. You know, obviously, there are Iranian Americans that would be complaining, but I don't see them getting on TV very much. I mean, sometimes they do, but not that often. And so it's just like what they did with the Palestinians, right? If you keep any respectable Palestinian off TV, then the only impression Americans will get is that you know, it's people who hijack planes or bomb airports or something like that, or, you know, and the same thing with the Iranians. You never see a respectable Iranian come on TV. I mean, there are some exceptions these days. Trita Parsi has been getting on TV, I'm happy to say. But it's still rare. And most people won't get that impression of Iranians, that they're just people. Let's sit down and talk and see, you know, it's the whole picture is, no, these people can't be trusted. What are we talking about? Out there, you can't trust these people. That's the impression Americans get, subliminally and sometimes extremely obviously.
Yep. And it's not just no Iranians, but it's just there's a very small number of people who've made it their hobby or their, you know, who made a decision that they want to keep up with the history of the Iranian nuclear program and the negotiations surrounding it. You know what I mean? It's you, me, Trita, and a handful of other people even care at all or have been paying that much attention. So when it comes to especially TV news, all the presumptions always are left standing. No one ever says, well, actually, that's not quite true about any aspect of the thing, because none of them know anything about it. So it just becomes what everybody knows, that they're making nukes, threatening Israel every day and this kind of thing.
Right. And, you know, even if they were to have somebody on, you know, like Mohammed Sahimi or Gareth Porter, you know, they would feel compelled to bring someone on to rebut that person. Because they couldn't just let that person speak, you know, by him herself or herself.
Right.
But on the other hand, the other side gets on by themselves all the time, and you know, without anybody to challenge them, including from the interviewer. So in even sort of subtle ways, the case is so rigged that no wonder the American people generally think, and I heard Rand Paul saying yesterday, that Iran is a threat.
Yeah, and he always said that. And you're a liar if you say that he changed his position on that. Anyway, yeah, no, and it's funny because I saw, too, where Rouhani, the president of Iran, gave this speech where he's like, man, we're really excited about this deal, and we think that maybe this can be a good first step toward, you know, friendlier relations with our neighbors. And he seemed to be talking about Saudi and Israel and America, and this could sort of be the end of the Cold War here, the beginning of the end of it. It's something, I'm putting words in his mouth, but it was more or less along those lines. And the State Department immediately said, not a chance, pal. We hate your guts. We still hate you. This negotiation is about the nuclear program, full stop, and should no way be taken to mean that we would ever negotiate with you about anything else, you terrorist.
Right, right. And of course, the latest reporting today, I heard it summarized on CNN or MSNBC, but didn't see anybody quoted. They have Rouhani saying if sanctions aren't lifted the day of the signing of the agreement, we're not going to sign the agreement. So now they're putting out this negative news that maybe things aren't going so well.
Right. Well, and they still have plenty of time to screw it up, too. And, I actually saw the Israelis had said, well, maybe if they would completely close down Fordo and resolve the possible military dimensions, which that's in the deal, that they would resolve that. So that should be taken care of. And they have one more demand, which I forget. Oh, and immediate inspections everywhere all the time. And I thought at first maybe that was a climb down, but then I guess they really can't say we demand, or they can, but they would rather not say we demand a complete end to all nuclear everything. So they're still just making impossible demands, trying to sabotage it. Seeming yep. reasonable ones. So I took that climb down out of context. It wasn't one. Anyway, so, we'll have more to cover along these lines. Thanks again for coming back on the show to talk about it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That's the great Sheldon Richmond, y'all. SheldonRichmond.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got a guy. He's hacking together sound bites with music, and I'm going to convince Ian to let me play those things instead of the Onion News so you won't have to listen to that stupid crap anymore. I heard the first rough draft last night. It wasn't so rough at all. It was great. And he's going to make a few different ones, and you'll get sick of those pretty soon, too, but not as quickly as you'll get sick of listening to the Onion Radio News. All right. Anyway, on to our next guest. It's the great Jeff Tucker from Liberty.me, and he's got a brand new article out about, you might guess, murder. What is murder? What is police work? It's at tucker.liberty.me. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you?
Hey, it's good to be here. I couldn't help but write about that subject. Did you watch the video, Scott?
I'm afraid I have seen the video. Yes, sir.
How many times did you watch it? I mean, I can't stop watching it. It's one of the most chilling videos I've ever seen.
I've seen a lot of videos of cops murdering people before. But yeah. No, actually, I've only seen the very beginning of it where he actually murders them, and then I've seen the clips where he plants it, but I never actually sat and watched the whole thing all the way through. So well, go ahead and tell us what you've learned.
I think one of the things that
we're talking about the murder of Walter Scott at the hands of the North Charleston police officer. I'm sorry, I forget his name. I don't have it in front of me. The murderer cop.
I'd have to look it up.
I'll find it while you're talking.
Yeah, okay, good. One of the reasons I keep watching it is that it is sort of sterile. It's not bloody. You don't see a real, scuffle going on. There's not a lot of punching like you've seen a lot of police videos. Mm-hmm. It's just a guy who just tries to run away. And then a cop pulls out his gun and calmly shoots him like he's like an animal or something and shoots him 8 times in the back.
Michael Slager is the offender's
Michael
name.
Slager. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ex-military, by the way. So he shoots the guy 8 times in the back and then walks over to him, calmly and tells him to put his hands behind his back. Put your hands behind your back. Well, the guy's dead, right? So he pulls a dead man's arms, behind him and handcuffs him, I mean, what is that about? The whole thing is just so chilling and so awful and terrifying. And yet so inevitable. And the only reason we know about it, because there happened to be a bystander, who took out his iPhone or whatever and shot a picture of what was going on. But otherwise, the officer had submitted a report that just seems like sheer fantasy. that there's somehow the victim, you know, had been trying to grab the taser gun and had been wrestling with the police, and so the policeman thought he was under threat or something like that, and so then he pulled his gun and shot him, you know, just to spare his life, which is the report that initially came out. And then the video came out. Actually, it was handed to the victim's parent, you know, and so suddenly the whole story begins to unravel. And it's only because of that video that this is even a controversy at all. But I think this is extremely significant in many ways, and it could prompt a real rethinking. You know, purpose of my article is really to kind of confront the fact about the state. I think what we're seeing in operation here is not so much unusual. It's not so much abuse, although it is abuse, but I think it's a system-wide violence, or what you see in the video is the sort of the violence inherent in the system in a way. Essentially, any of us who resist the state are putting ourselves in the position of being killed instantly. And I know that there are certain rules and regulations for when the cops can shoot and when they can't. But what this case illustrates is that if the cop is in the position of telling the story, you know, they can almost always win. And what's unusual about this case is that the city itself, accused the guy of murder, which was very interesting and highly unusual. Whether that conviction will stand, I just don't know.
Yeah, I was surprised. I think it's unprecedented, really, that he would get a murder charge, maybe, you know, some kind of involuntary manslaughter or some kind of thing. For them to charge him with murder is really something else. And I guess,
well, and I think
I'm so jaded. I think there has to be some, there's an agenda behind it. Like the Rand Corporation must've done a study where they said, we are losing the last shreds of our legitimacy here. And some goat has to be scaped, you know?
Right. And well, and to any viewer on YouTube who saw that thing for the first time, your first thought is, oh my God, they murdered the guy, you know? So this claim that his arraignment on a murder charge just follows from the common sense, the police murdered him. But I guess, you know, the argument I made in my piece was that, there's really not that much difference between all sort of acts of the state and just everyday murder, that they're really essentially the same thing, that the state exercises a kind of illegitimate power over society that once you see it in the raw, like you see it in this video, it just impresses you with just how incredibly and obviously immoral it is. Mm-hmm. So as you know, my own perspective on the world is that we don't need a state, right? I think that society can manage itself just fine. And I don't ever like to think of that position, although it sounds rarefied and weird and highly ideological and utopian. To my own mind, I like to think of it as just an extension of common moral sense that we all have. Namely, that there should not be certain privileged people in a society who have the legal right to aggress against others and kill them, just for their refusal to comply. You know, and the police are really in a position of killing anytime, anywhere. I said in my article that I'm almost certain that I could get myself killed, very quickly. I'm talking to you from Atlanta. I could go out on the street right now, behave oddly, do whatever, attract the attention of the police. And when they tell me to stop and ask for my identification, if I tried to flee, they tried to capture me and I got away and I fled again. I have no doubt in my mind that I would be, you know, get 8 bullets in the back and be shot instantly.
Right. The libertarians, it's funny, this particular example is the one the libertarians always use, that, like, they'll kill you over a taillight, man, because if you resist, then you will be sentenced to death on the spot if you sufficiently defend yourself from the most minor thing. You know, if you get fined for cutting someone's hair without a license and you don't show up in court on your ticket, then ultimately they'll bring the SWAT team. And what's funny is the defenders concede this in a sense, the defenders of the cops. Well, he shouldn't have been running. He shouldn't have been resisting at all. He should have been at 1,000,000% compliant from the very beginning, and then he never would have gotten executed. So it's his own damn fault, because everybody knows that those are the rules going in.
No, a state only needs to use violence when people are not complying with its orders. If everybody is obeying completely, then even a totalitarian society can seem to be perfectly peaceful. The violence is only used when people dare to disagree with their masters, essentially. Do you know that there's a very interesting sort of background? It wasn't just a taillight, that's why he was stopped. But the reason why Walter Scott tried to get away is that they thought they were arresting him for failure to pay child support. And he had been arrested several times in the past for not paying child support, which is by itself a very strange institution. I mean, this is basically a bill that you owe. They're like a credit card bill or any other bill. But because it's ordered by the courts, it becomes a crime not to pay it. So I tried to look up the figures, like how many people are in jail in this country for failure to pay child support. And the best figure I could come up with was 50,000. And there's really bad data on this. We don't really know, but 50,000 seems, which seems to me low, because when I was in jail that one time, I bumped into a lot of people who hadn't paid child support and sitting there in jail. Very strange thing. Like, how are you going to pay child support from jail? You know, I mean, this is not a very good
path. I remember back in the 90s, they were creating a jobs database of where everyone in America worked on the federal level so that we can enforce child support, garnish your wages anytime you get hired anywhere.
And isn't it strange? I find it so odd that we would have a system that would put people in jail for failure to pay, as if that's going to somehow... I don't know what you think you're accomplishing through that, because certainly they're not going to earn any money. They're not going to be able to support the family from jail. So I don't really get that. So, I mean, to me, I don't know why there's not a national scandal about this. I mean, it just seems so outrageous. And so this guy, Walter Scott, he was kind of doing what any reasonable person would do. I mean, he felt like he was going to be captured. He didn't want to be captured, you know, and I think that's sort of, you know, biologically normal for anybody. Any animal doesn't want to be captured, and certainly human beings don't want to be captured. But there's another factor too, that he didn't want to be dragged off to jail again for this child support thing. And maybe he wanted to actually continue to pay, to support his family as best he could by staying out of jail, and knew that this was a fundamental threat, whatever it was. He decided that he wanted out of there.
All right, hang on one second. Hang on one second here, Jeff. I'll be right back with you, dude. Sorry, we got technical difficulties. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. Sorry about that. Everything should be fixed now. Chat room, guys, you hear me okay? All right. We're online with Jeff Tucker talking about the murder of Walter Scott and his article. Oh, and by Michael Slager, a cop from North Charleston, South Carolina. Jeffrey's article is at tucker.liberty.me. And that's at liberty.me. Tucker.liberty.me. What is murder? What is police work? And we're talking about how, yeah, the government, they kill people all the time, and they use the credible threat of murder all the time. That's how they get their way. That's what the state is. Those in society have the right to threaten to murder the rest of us all the time. And pardon me, Jeff, I forget right where we were when we left off. Do you remember?
Well, I don't know. But, you know, I don't know exactly. But, here's the thing. Most people, if you ask them, does a policeman have the right to shoot you if you run away when he tries to arrest you? What do you think most people would answer to that? I think most people would say, yeah, probably. I think probably so. Don't you think most people would sort of believe that?
Yeah, I do. I think, yeah, so too. Yeah, it's comply or die. That's the law.
Yeah, I think so. So I was a little confused about this, too, because I watched this video and I said, but, you know, it was very obvious to me, a case of murder. But it was not obvious to me whether or not the policeman was complying with the regulations or not, which can sometimes be very vague and arcane. And as we talked about earlier, it's very strange that actually he was arrested as, yeah, you know, on a murder charge, you know. So the New York Times this morning runs a very interesting piece, and the question they're asking is whether or not policemen can actually shoot people when they're fleeing. And what they say in the very opening section here, you know, can a police officer legally shoot a fleeing subject in the back? And they say that simple question has a not-so-simple answer. It depends. So what does it depend on? Well, it depends on whether or not the fleeing person was somehow, you know, a threat to the officer, that he tried to grab his gun or whatever. Of course, police can always make that stuff up. Another condition is whether or not the officer believes that the fleeing suspect is a threat, could be a threat to other people, right? So that's then basically a subjective judgment. Anybody running away from the police, if he believes that the guy is going to run off and do something bad, then it's somehow in the public interest to stop him by shooting him in the back. So, and this article concludes that based on the video, it doesn't look like any of those conditions were true. On the other hand, it seems to me that if that's the regulations, then you pretty much have given all power to policemen to do whatever they want.
Right. It's only the video that has him in trouble at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right, because otherwise, everybody would have to have believed the police report, which claimed that the guy was, you know, just a terrible threat. He was doing terrible things and had grabbed his taser and that there was a scuffle. There was certain passive voice, you know, nobody causes a scuffle. A scuffle just somehow happens. And so the police in self-defense, you know, pulled out his gun and just very regrettably had to murder the man, you know.
Yeah. Well, and just wait till his lawyer comes out and says, well, he was reaching for his waistband, so I concluded he must have another gun there. They just say what they want. Waistband.
Yeah, whatever they want.
Yeah, out the door.
Yeah, that's, and, you know, I hope that and we're learning something very interesting from this. Because, you know, we've kind of, ever since YouTube came along and people have had video cameras in their pockets, we've seen ever more of these sort of police abuse videos. And it's never clear to people, really. Are we seeing things for the first time? Has it always been this way?
Yes, absolutely.
Or is it getting worse? But I think you're right. Yeah, I think it's always been this way. It's just we're seeing it now for the first time. And what's interesting to me is the prospect that the sort of sheer ubiquity of these videos and the universal reach of them is going to cause a kind of fundamental rethinking of political philosophy. You know, I mean, do we really want a special class of citizens that have the right to kill you if you don't comply with their every edict, no matter how just or unjust? Do we want that kind of society?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that's really antithetical to every notion of freedom and equality that we have. And yet that is, to my way of thinking, the very essence of what a state is and does. It seems to me that a video like this really has to give rise to a really fundamental debate about the role of the state and whether we need it, what it is, whether it's a moral institution. And that's why I concluded my article. I said, you know, what you see in this movie is exactly what you think it is. It's fundamentally evil, but so is the state itself. You know, I really do believe that. I don't see this as being somehow a weird, you know, anomaly, but rather it is the kind of system that we've created, where the state lords it over person and property and every aspect of life. And it's just we don't like to look at it. We'd rather the violence of the state be sort of sterilized, you know, out of view, not like this. And yet this video just, you know, forces the questions that we all need to be asking. at their very core.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny, too, in a not very funny way, how all of these are basically, they start as some innocuous thing. You know, this guy Mike Brown is walking down the middle of the street on a Sunday morning on this tiny little out-of-the-way dead-end street, right? So he might as well be on the sidewalk already. He's not doing anything. Same thing for this guy. He's driving. He's got his tail light out. As you said, maybe he's a deadbeat. Maybe, you know, the courts have determined he's a deadbeat on paying for his child support. But still, and we see, you know, there was one, well, you read all day, every day at the Free Thought Project or Cop Block or whatever about atrocity after atrocity. And it's always, you know, the one I read the other day was the guy was accused of maybe possessing a personal amount of pot. And it was one of those where the cops knew this guy. They all went to school together. It was like, you know, episode of Roseanne or whatever, where everybody knows the local cop. And he was the one who led the SWAT raid and killed this guy in his own home over, and then he didn't even have any weed. It's always this ridiculous kind of crap where, you know, like this guy, they said he wasn't a criminal. Maybe he was a deadbeat, but there was nothing else bad about him. He was trying to work. He wasn't a didn't have a record of armed robbery or whatever kind of thing. He's just a regular guy who ends up at the dead end of a cop's bullet. So all the fantasies about, well, yeah, some people get shot by cops, like liquor store robbers or whatever. No, it's really, you would like to think that it's limited to them, but no, it's really not. It's everyday people going about their everyday lives.
You, Scott, you follow foreign affairs very closely. Something that occurs to me as a sort of an afterthought every time I watch a video like this is that, you know, this isn't just watched by Americans. This is watched by people all over the world.
Yeah.
What do you think this does to people's perception of what America is as a society? Do you think that it mortifies people? You know, in the same way it affects us. I mean, what do you think this does to us internationally? I mean, how does it affect?
I think probably they think now you know how it feels. You know, this is what it's like. You know, the CIA is the boogeyman of the world that everybody is terrified of. The Americans and their military and their assassination lists and this kind of thing that's been going on for decades. And so I think probably they go, well, you know, this is what it feels like. And then I think probably they watch our TV news and they go, oh, well, no wonder they're all such idiots and have no idea what's really going on around here. When, you know, you show Fox News on a satellite to someone anywhere else in the world, they're just going to be facepalm shaking their head, you know?
Yeah,
no wonder
yeah.
the Americans want to kill me if this is what they're being told all day.
This is what they're being told, right? Well, there's also the fact that the State Department, you know, is always hectoring everybody in the world and every government in the world over, you know, about the human rights abuses. Well, you've got to fix your human rights abuses. You know, mm-hmm. they're always throwing stones, you know, at other governments around the world. And yet these videos are coming out, you know, half a dozen per day.
Yeah, I saw a Twitter yesterday that said if any other country, if this was going on, the proportion of police killings, our State Department would tell us not to go there. It would give us an advisory against this place.
That's a very funny line. Well, it's not really funny. It's actually deeply tragic. But, you know, you talk about undermining the U.S.'s moral credibility, whatever it has left around the world. I mean, this kind of stuff is just absolutely chilling. And, you know, the debate so far, and I've become very curious about this particular case, and I'm not sure why. There's something about the video that just riveted me. I couldn't help it but write about it. The debate so far is centering on issues that are important, but probably not central. You know, like people always want to talk about the racial element to these things. And I have no doubt that that plays a role here. You know, there was a sense of which, you know, you got from watching the video that this white cop just figured this black man's life was completely expendable. And that's true. And there is a good debate to have about, you know, the kinds of regulations that restrain police and all the rest of it. But the more fundamental issue that I try to raise is essentially one of, you know, a class difference between the state and the rest of us, you know, a privileged class that has this violence, this right to use violence and then the rest of us who are just, you know, required to comply with every rule and edict without exercising our brains or our volition at all. I mean, to me, that is just not the kind of society that really anybody wants. And yet that's exactly what we've created.
Yeah, I think, well, and the racial issue plays into the class issue because, of course, black people are disproportionately poorer and have less political power. And so they're the low-hanging fruit. If a cop wants to go out for target practice, you know, hunting men, he knows he's got a better chance. Or let's say he's got, it's much less likely that his prey is going to turn out to be the son of a congressman or the nephew of a judge or somebody that's going to actually get him in trouble, right? This is the people that are easier to pick on because there's much less accountability, for picking.
Well, and I felt a little bit squeamish about the whole thing because, when the news was first released, you know, that within the day, you know, Walter Scott's complete criminal record dating back to 1987 was suddenly made public, in sort of the creepiest, you know, possible way, I thought, anyway. I mean, it was just kind of, and it's interesting that you almost get this message from this sort of news making that if anybody has a blemish anywhere in their whole lives, then they're fair game, you know. So, and I probably it's the case that the police understand this. They know who is likely to, you know, who makes better fodder than anybody else. And Walter Scott fit the demographic type very closely.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, you can hear, you know, cops. I interviewed a cop yesterday. You may be familiar with this guy, Rayford Davis. He's a former cop and now he's a libertarian and an activist with, law enforcement against prohibition. And
yeah, I think I've heard him speak before. These people are amazing, actually. I love these guys.
Yeah, yeah, he was on the show yesterday, and he was talking about, well, I forgot what my point was going to be, but I know another one I'll make, which was he started to say this is all because of the war on drugs. Oh, well, this reminds me. It's drug laws and licensing and inspection stickers and brake lights and it's infractions, offenses against the state, not crimes against people, but just little things that they're sent out to enforce. And so he was talking about how it just makes society meaner and how it makes the cops meaner. Because you have some of these cops figure, okay, you know, I should be the county's security guard. I'm up for that job, whatever. And then they spend their day all day taking people to jail for nothing. And they end up rationalizing it. They're looking into the abyss, and it stares back into them, and they become as mean as the state ever was, carrying out its edicts. And, of course, and this goes, again, back to Ferguson and back to race, because they don't treat everybody in St. Louis like this. But the blacks in North St. Louis, they are basically have the job of paying through fees and fines for the cost of the government for everybody else. And they're just basically they're just tax slaves up there in their ghetto. And they're the federal report said that 80-something percent, it was definitely better than 75% of them, have active warrants out. And they all have warrants out for failure to appear for a fine that they can't pay for an infraction that they didn't do to anybody. And it's the super duper majority of the entire population, you know, way more than enough to override a veto or amend the Constitution. You know what I mean? Those levels of proportion. And they all got warrants out all day long. They're prey for these guys all day long.
Isn't it amazing? And yet our public debate, I mean, I find it incredible. The Obama administration a couple of weeks ago made this big whoop-de-doo thing and Obama speaking or whatever, and they want to propose regulations against the payday lending industry because they say that it's exploitative of the poor, you know, that it charges, you know, high interest rates, you know, $25 for a $200 loan over the course of 2 weeks or something like that. And so they want, you know, federal regulations on this stuff. And, you know, you're reading these things and, you know, I mean, that's exactly what strikes me. It's like, if you really want to eliminate exploitation of the poor in this country, you know, don't start with the thing that's actually helping them get fast cash and the needs of emergency. You need to go straight to local governments and governments at all levels, really, that are exploiting the poor in the most egregious possible ways. Look at the court costs and the fines that the poor, you know, are forced to pay, money they don't have, and the way they enter into this sort of cycle of being in and out of the system. It's just grim, and it's sheer robbery. And yet, you know, I don't hear Obama even talking about this.
No, of course not. They never talk about what they're doing to keep people poor. And yeah, of course, if you have a court date in municipal court, that means you got to take off work in the middle of the work week. They're not open. This isn't night court, the sitcom, where you get to figure out some kind of time off to work this out. You have to figure out how to not get fired, but still get a day off in the middle of the week to go and take care of this nonsense, too, which is not easy for people.
And do you think, Scott, that it's actually significant? I mean, it strikes me as significant that all of this kind of stuff is happening, even though this nation elected this African American president, you know, with the perception that somehow, you know, his demographic and background would lead to, you know, a greater degree of racial justice and freedom than we'd had before. And yet, look what's happening. I mean, you know, all this stuff is pouring out of the news. We have a greater perception of a racially exploited class of people in this country than ever before. And I don't see any efforts on the part of the federal government to do anything about it. You know, which I think should be a lesson to us that, you know, if you want freedom for your people, the least good way to go about that is to seek political power and reform from the top down.
Right. Yeah. In fact, Jesse Walker was just pointing out an interview with Barack Obama the other day where he was talking about the consequences of the drug war on innocent people and black communities. And he was talking about it like he hadn't been the president this whole time since 2009. Like, who are you? I've been sitting here in the peanut gallery watching the way things work. And you have a good point there about the ridiculous drug war and the way that we enforce it. And yet it's all in his hands. So much of it is in his hands. Like, for example, if he wanted to reschedule cocaine and pot and those most basic drugs, the psychedelics, and just say these are now Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 drugs with some limited medical usage and no longer felonies, whatever, he could do that right now in this instant. He wouldn't even have to write it down. He could just say it to someone.
I don't know. Sometimes I really do wonder if the longer these people stay in office, the more they sort of internalize the reality that they really are just sort of PR people, salesmen of their own careers, guardians of their own legacy. They're not really exercising any actual power. I wonder if they internalize that sense. You know, I don't really know. And it's not really clear. At least it's never been clear to me just how much a president really has discretion over the kind of policies that occur under his watch. Yeah. I really don't know.
I mean, it's only a percentage of what's going on. Not a lot of it, but some of those things seem like they're pretty easy within his reach. But then again, I don't know. I mean, what would the DEA do to a president who tried to legalize drugs like that, you know, just by rescheduling them?
You're right that on paper he can do that, but what about the reality? You know, it's always unclear to me. Just once in the whole history of this country, I'd like for one ex-president to write an honest account of what the hell the president does, how much power he has, you know, to tell the truth about what really went on. I don't think we've ever seen an honest account.
Yeah, no, you just see glimpses of it, like when Bush complained that the CIA told the truth that the Iranians weren't making nukes. And so he was then, well, now how was I supposed to bomb them when the official position of the government was that they weren't even making nukes? Oy vey, you know, he's all upset. Telling the truth out from under me and messing me up.
You know, there's that great moment in that movie, Nixon. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's just a great movie.
I love it. Yeah, great movie.
Isn't it good?
Yeah.
But you remember when he confronts all the kids, you know, it's at the Lincoln Memorial or whatever,
uh-huh.
and he tells them that he doesn't really have the power to do what he would probably like to do.
Right.
And there's like stunned silence. And I thought that was a very compelling scene because it seemed to me very believable, actually, that at some level, presidents would sort of internalize this sense that they're really observers and spokespeople more than they are real actors and exercisers of power.
Yeah.
I know that.
I'm pretty sure that that's based on a real exchange. That, I mean, we all know that he did go there to the Lincoln Memorial and all that and talk to those kids, but I'm under the impression, I forget my source though now, that that really happened and that that was the exchange between him and that girl. You can't stop it, can you? And he's like, oh, well, I guess no. No, don't suppose I can, young lady.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that probably is a real exchange. I know Nikita Khrushchev said something very similar when he was premier or whatever they called him at the Soviet Union, that he felt like that he had essentially no power or ability to control the system at all, even though he was, you know, this autocratic dictator, right? And he compared the government and the whole system that ran the Soviet Union to a tub of lard. No, to a tub of dough. He said, you know, you punch it, you manipulate it, you try to shape it, but in the end, it's just a big tub of dough.
Yeah, sounds all right. A tub of dough that will kill you, like the blonde. All right. Hey, listen, I got to go, but thanks so much. Good to talk to you again. Everybody, tomorrow night, me and Jeff Tucker host an Eye on the Empire for the third time over at liberty.me. Thanks again.
Looking forward to it. Bye-bye.
In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Sorry about all the technical troubles today. I hope you're still there, but you wouldn't be able to hear me say that if you weren't, so I guess you are. Everything should be all right now. All right. So, yeah, now back to the wars. No, first, Jeff Tucker and I are hosting Eye on the Empire at liberty.me tomorrow night at, I think, 9? Yeah, 9 Eastern time. 8 Texas time. And what's going to happen is we're going to talk about things. It's going to be great. That's Eye on the Empire, hosted by myself and Jeff Tucker, on the subject of the Empire. So if you like that interview, well, then you'll like Eye on the Empire. Now, back to the wars here, man. So, the Islamic State is now just 3 miles from Assad's palace in Damascus. The Yarmouk camp takeover, a problem for Palestinians, a bigger one for Syria. Yeah, it's a terrible problem for Palestinians. A week of offensives have left ISIS in control of the Yarmouk refugee camp, a massive Palestinian refugee camp in metro Damascus. This is adding to the humanitarian woes for the camp's residents since the civil war began, at least for the estimated 15,000 of the original 200,000 residents who remain. It's perhaps an even bigger problem for the Syrian government, however, as having fended off the PLO and Hamas, ISIS now has control over a camp just 3 miles from the presidential palace in central Damascus. The military had all but given up on the camp before, leaving it switching among various pro- and anti-rebel Palestinian factions. The ISIS takeover is obliging them to rethink their position, however, and to try to muster some air power against the camp. Unfortunately, so far that means barrel bombs, the makeshift weapons that Syria has increasingly relied on as the war drags on, and which are known for being wildly inaccurate and endangering civilians. The bombings are sure to fuel international criticism of the Syrian government's tactics, but with ISIS so close to their seat of power, they're almost certain to continue. So, wow, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm surprised it has come to that. I guess the Islamic State really did seize a hell of a lot of American equipment last summer. And apparently they've been using it pretty damn effectively. And then I guess that's part of having a giant refugee camp full of Palestinians, you know, 3/8 compromise types, no man's land men. No offense, I just mean, you know, they're poor, wretched selves. That's part of having them right on the outskirts of the capital city, right? It's this permanent, unruled place. It's been a haven for various jihadist groups and now for the Islamic State. The easiest place to move right in. But I don't know what to tell you, man. If you remember back, say, I don't know, 8 years ago. 12. When they invaded Iraq, they de-Ba'athified the government, and they abolished the army. And then it became a war of some against all, and it was ugly as hell. And approximately 1 million people died, and about 4.5-5 million were made refugees. An entire society was destroyed. And Syria's already been through hell, and they've already had a couple 100,000 casualties themselves in the last 4 years. In this bloody war. But if the state of Syria falls to the Islamic State and their Al-Qaeda de facto allies, the Al-Nusra Front, and they rule Damascus, and then they have, three borders with, two major borders with Lebanon surround it, direct access to the Mediterranean Sea. I don't know about, the Islamic State, but Al-Nusra's been able to cut a deal with the Israelis, no problem, so I guess that won't be a problem. We prefer these bad guys to those bad guys, as Michael Oren explained. And then, yeah, I don't know. I guess, all the Christians and all the Shiites and all the Alawites will all become refugees or corpses. Because the Al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State aren't going to cut them any slack. It's kind of crazy to think, you know, even after months of the so-called caliphate being declared, not just a de facto kind of Islamic State, you know, a terrorist group, a rebel group called that, an armed group calling themselves that, they actually have a state. And they declared it back last June. They've had a de facto one longer than that, but they've got it out right now. And the policy in Syria has still been, well, let's go ahead and let them finish off Assad and the Ba'athists, and then we'll worry about them. God, really? I mean, they've been bombing al-Nusra here and ISIS there in Syria, but not that much. Killed quite a few civilians. The vast majority of all their air power efforts have been in Iraq. And they keep funneling arms and guns, and they keep not stopping the Turks and the Saudis and the rest from supporting them, including the Israelis now, outright supporting them. And it's almost unbelievable. I almost can't believe it. But apparently they have decided on still regime change. And then again, I don't know who all's they. It's true that Joe Biden and John Kerry both, I think, said we're gonna have to talk to Assad. We're gonna have to accept the fact of his existence. It's crazy to think otherwise, that after the declaration of the caliphate, after Al-Qaeda got out of control times 10,000, far beyond what you ever wanted and went the wrong way instead of Damascus. They went to Mosul first, all of that. They're going to continue on? It's almost unthinkable. But they did. And so I don't know, man. I guess, I don't know. Obama could stop him, right? He is still the president. I know he's got a lot on his plate and everything. But if the official policy of the President of the United States, and he really meant it and meant to be firm about it, was that Turkey and Israel and Saudi and Qatar and their friends must, and he really means it, stop financing the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State war in Syria right now, I think they would have to do it, right? He's just not willing to call them out that much. And I guess he figures, like he told Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2012, when maybe if you were an idiot, you could believe in this madness, where he said, yes, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg, this would be a good way to take Iran down a peg, would be to separate them from their ally in Syria by overthrowing the regime there. Wow. As horrible and insane as that was then, that's not out of the question now. In 2015, when we're already almost a year into the declared and real, in real life, Islamic State, in former Iraqi Sunnistan and eastern Syria. And now really they're going to help him go all the way to Damascus? I'm not calling for a bombing campaign, but damn, you got to stop supporting them, for crying out loud. And I wonder if they told Turkey, hey man, we'll kick your ass right out of NATO. We'll put Iran-level sanctions on you right now if you don't close that goddamn border. What would they do? Nothing? If they told the Saudis, hey man, you said you didn't want us to make friends with Iran. We will make friends with Iran and support an invasion of your crappy little continent if you don't stop financing the bin Ladenites in Syria. They could do that. It probably wouldn't take that, right? But they're not doing it. Maybe it's too late now. Anyway, I don't know. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll see you tomorrow.